Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today I have my sometimes host, John Galloway, with me. John, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Well, I'm glad to have you here, especially today. We have John, do I say Sanmez? Am I saying that right?
You're saying it perfect.
You would think I would have checked that before we began. John Sanmez is the founder of Simple Programmer, where he tirelessly pursues his vision of transforming complex issues into simple solutions. John has published, now check this out, over 50 courses on Pluralsight on topics such as iOS, Android, .NET, Java, game development for the online developer training resources. He also co-hosts the Get Up and Code podcast, where he talks about fitness for programmers. John, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great, and I'm really glad to have you here. And there are a lot of things I want to talk about, not fitness for programmers. But other than that, you have an extraordinary record and number of courses for Pluralsight. How long have you been doing that?
Oh, let's see. It's been about, I want to say, just about 2 years, a little under 2 years.
So under 2 years, 50 courses, that's one every other week.
Yeah. I've been churning them out pretty rapidly.
Are you doing anything else? Are you sleeping? Are you eating? How are you doing that?
Well, I will admit that to give a little backstory, the Pluralsight opportunity for me, when I saw that opportunity, I thought this is the best opportunity that may come along in my life. my wife actually said that to me, but I really started just, I said, I am going to do this. I'm going to make the most of this, and I am just going to, whatever it takes, I'm going to produce as much as possible. And so I've for those 2 years, I have basically, put in just very, very long days and just really dedicated, I'd say dedicated my life to producing Pluralsight courses.
Brilliant. Well, your timing was perfect because the is clearly some kind of curve of when to do Pluralsight courses and when there'll be a whole lot of other authors and a whole lot of courses. And you were clearly there for the really sweet spot. That's not to suggest that it's not going to continue, but your timing was nearly perfect. And I assume that it has been rewarding in many ways.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. I've always been looking for opportunities. Like I said, when I saw this opportunity, I've been a real estate investor since I was 18, and I've always been trying to, my big goal has always been to try and generate some income to be able to put into my real estate so that I could have, that's my retirement plan. And Pluralsight has really helped me to be able to do that. So I've been very happy to do that. And I've pretty much just poured everything that I've been able to make into real estate. And I'm in a place now where I feel like I have a secure future. So that's something that I'm very happy about.
That's wonderful. I'm probably in the exact opposite position. The only real estate I own is the house I'm in. It is fortunately not upside down, but it's not far. I have about $1.49 saved for my retirement, which is not all that far away. And so we're not going to discuss this topic either.
Let's move on.
Moving on to technology. John, I have to tell you that the place where I encountered your courses was in the Service Stack course, which is a brilliant course. It's extremely clear. It's paced beautifully. But it also raises the question about Service Stack itself as a technology, as a really interesting technology. And I wonder if we could start there.
Sure. Yeah. Service Stack is one of those. I do a lot of courses, of course, but Service Stack was one of those courses that I was like, I have to make this course when I started using the technology, because it is just, it felt like a breath of fresh air to me. I'd used Web API and a lot of other Microsoft services for creating web services and stuff. And I'm not trying to knock any of those, but the approach that Service Stack took, I felt like was just so simple and so clear, and was able to combine a lot of the things that I was having to do in a lot of different other places. And I felt like that was just such a compelling thing that people need to learn how easy this was, because once you saw how easily you could set up a web service and just get it running and support the different formats, that it would be a huge benefit.
Well, I'm going to encourage John Galloway to jump in from a good bit of this conversation, both because he always has good insights and because he's a ASP.NET evangelist for Microsoft. But let me start by saying that when Microsoft's offering was WCF, there was a whole lot of work and a whole lot of song and dance in putting up a web service. But that's greatly diminished with Web API. And Web API is nicely integrated into sort of the look and feel of MVC. Are these two technologies in direct competition with each other, or are they somehow in different spheres?
I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, you could definitely use Service Stack instead of using Web API, mm-hmm. right? It's definitely can fulfill that role for a lot of cases, but I don't think it's going to fulfill the role for all cases. I think, you know, it really depends on what you're trying to do. It's so hard to say now because so many people are using web services in so many different ways. I think, the thing to know about Service Stack is there's a lot of questions that are unanswered. There's a lot of space out there. I get a lot of questions from people about Service Stack, and they say, well, how do I do this kind of security thing or this kind of extend it in this way? And my answer is sometimes like, well, you're going to kind of have to figure that out, because there's not enough people that are using this. It's not, you know, this is mostly one man's dream. That's built this, not like a full Microsoft product. And I think that's where, you know, Web API has more of these scenarios figured out, because more professional developers and enterprises have used Web API and have built all those case scenarios have been hit. And so the thing about Service Stack, I would say, is you're going to get up quickly. You're going to get a very fast benefit of getting web services and being able to do a lot of things in a very simple way. But if you start going really deep into the weeds, you're going to be blazing your own trail, where I feel like on the Web API side, there's always an answer to just about any question that I could think of. But maybe John has a better take on it than I do on that.
Yeah, you know, first of all, I have to say I have a huge amount of respect for Demis and what he's been doing with Service Stack. And, recently we put up a link we have on the ASP.NET site. We have some open source pages where we list things, and we listed that. And the way I think about it is Web API is free. Microsoft doesn't make any money. You don't pay Microsoft to use Web API. And Service Stack is another product out there, and Microsoft makes the same amount of money. You know, as long as you're running on a Microsoft server, go for it. You know, that's kind of the Microsoft business, you know, like thoughts on this. So I'm a fan of Service Stack. I've used some of the other libraries, you know, like, Service Stack has a lot of cool stuff to it. In addition, so there's the service layer side to it, but then there's also a ton of other things like serialization. Yeah. I've used the Redis client. I mean, there's a lot to it.
Let's fill in on that. They have what for me is one of the nicest lightweight IOC or dependency injection options, and they have a really nice lightweight ORM that really complement the web service part beautifully. But go ahead, John Galloway.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm obviously more familiar with like the ASP.NET and the Web API side of it. And I think a lot of it is, you know, they're kind of different flavors on, and John, I'm hoping you'll kind of set me straight or argue on some of this, but I think they're kind of different. You can do the same things generally with Web API and with Service Stack, but it's kind of more of like philosophy and the approach to it. And I find that a lot of time, obviously the sample code in Service Stack is more kind of, I don't know, it's definitely kind of focused on, you know, it's very lightweight and usually fewer lines of code. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's like you said, there's the philosophy of, you know, and it's kind of, I'd say that people can use Web API in the way that they use ServiceStack, but ServiceStack seems to lend itself more towards the whole, you're going to, instead of having like maybe 15 different methods based around customer, you're going to have one or two, and you're going to pass in a query object, and then you're going to just have that one endpoint do something with that query object and return you back an object. So it's a more of a smaller surface area for designing your web services, where you're working with that pattern versus web API naturally lending itself more like, and like I said, I think people could use web API in that same way, but ServiceStack just tends to lend itself for that type of model if you want to operate that way. The other thing I thought actually funny that just occurred to me as you're talking about the Microsoft servers is the other side of ServiceStack being that you can run it on mono, and so you could, I mean, for a lot of people, and you know definitely I'm not trying to knock the Microsoft services that are out there, but for a lot of people, when they're just getting an idea up and started and whatnot, they might have like a Linux server that they can get cheaply in the cloud. And before, they didn't really, like, you know, I've been in this situation myself, because primarily I like to call myself a Microsoft developer. C# is my favorite language. And when I went to set up some websites, I said, well, I don't want to, like, I'm just playing around here. I just want to, I want to use something as cheap and free as possible. And so I would set up a Linux server, and then I would be into the WordPress and PHP world and places where I didn't want to go until ServiceStack came along. Then I said, oh, wait a minute. Now I can take this thing. I can take Mono, put it on there. I can run basically my use C# and write web services and run it on a Linux box if I want to. I could move it over to Azure if I want to as well, but I can started off on this really cheap, basically free platform, and then move it over as it grows, or not if I don't want to. And then plus having the Redis support built in, that's another free tool that I can use out there, and I can run on a Linux server.
Yes, I'll jump in where John Galloway isn't and say that while all of that is so, Azure seems to be definitely making a strong play for reducing the cost of entry. And I think they've made some significant changes that have made that a viable alternative as well in terms of getting started. John, isn't there an intro deal where you get a certain amount, either free or very inexpensive?
Yeah, well, you get Windows Azure websites is kind of the equivalent of like shared hosting. So I would compare that to something where you're like, hey, I want to play with something for free or very cheap. And then you get, everybody gets 10 sites for free. And then you also, if you have MSDN, they throw a ton of stuff at you. So you get like $150 worth of credits a month. And it's pretty hard to spend $150 unless you're actually like doing something kind of substantial. So, but you know, I'm a fan also of, you know, Mono and just having that kind of that option. So, and I know I'm not sure where they're at with Web API being able to run on Mono as well. I've seen like there's blog posts out there occasionally of like, hey, here's my web API thing running there. But I don't think it's the focus so much as like ServiceStack. That's like, hey, it's kind of a differentiator. It's like, hey, this is a priority for us.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
One of the things that I noticed when I did my prototype app in using ServiceStack was that it felt very easy to get the dependency injection working and to get the database up and running. Are there significant limitations on those two pieces? Do you run into a wall when you start building something a little bit bigger, or are those really fully functional pieces?
That's a good question. I think, you know, actually I just encountered a problem where someone was asking me, they said, well, I have an existing database, and how do I get can I use the ORM with ServiceStack with that? And just to kind of go around and answer your question from the back door, basically, my answer was probably not. That's not going to take some work. And so I guess where I'm getting with that is that if you had something already in place, like it's a lightweight ORM. ServiceStack is going to give you a very lightweight ORM. It's not going to do what a lot of the other full blown ORMs are going to be able to do for you. So it's really designed to kind of scale with you with the app as you're creating a new. But aside from that, like if you're building the app with those, if you on a greenfield project, for example, and you're starting out with ServiceStack and you're using the ORM and you're using the IOC there, I don't see any reason why that's not going to scale up. I mean, especially when you think about it, like on the database side, of course you can use the ORM in Connect, or you can use the Redis client. Like Redis is going to scale up like a crazy amount. I mean, that's just it's insanely fast. It takes a little bit more work. But yeah, I don't really see you hitting any kind of, there's no reason why you would hit a cap there. Everything is very, very performant. The biggest thing where I think people do run into walls is like I said, when you're trying to, you know, a lightweight ORM is not going to do all of the features of a big solution in that space, like the ones that Microsoft puts out or even like in Hibernate. And sometimes when someone wants to do something more complicated, like they want to map entities from the database to different representations in their ORM, you don't really have that ability to do that with what's in ServiceStack. Now, with that said, you can of course swap out the ORM. You can swap out the IOC container in ServiceStack and use whatever you want.
You know, I had a neighbor who took in some kids from Chernobyl after the accident, so that they could get medical care here in Boston. And he took them to the drugstore. And they looked at the rows and rows and rows of different kinds of toothpaste and burst into tears because they were not used to that level of choice, and it was overwhelming. And yeah, to some degree, the developer community is beginning to suffer that same kind of shock of, no, just tell me which one to use, because there are too many choices and I don't know how to evaluate which one. And you start seeing the kinds of really prejudices coming out of the, well, it's got to be Microsoft because then everything is integrated and it's, you know, a company I trust, or it's got to be not Microsoft because they're still the evil empire or whatever. And these are non-rational decisions at that point. So one of the things that I think could be very, very valuable is the kind of conversation that you're beginning to have about, well, under these conditions, it makes sense, but under those conditions, it might not.
Yeah, that's such a good point. This is such a, you know, such a good observation, because it, you know, that's one thing I always try to tell people, like with the number of courses like that I did with Pluralsight, the number of technologies that I've visited, you know, I've learned about a lot of things that I wouldn't have normally learned about. And what I've come to realize is what you're saying is so true, which is that, you know, and really the reality is that, like, most things are good. Most things like that people are passionate about are actually good. Like, there's not like the best technology or the best choice, or this is so much better than the other. You know, the cream does rise to the top, and of all the things that people are doing, the popular frameworks and choices, they're all pretty much at the same level, because there's so much out there that what ends up happening is your choice really is not so important anymore, and it becomes, like you said, a situational thing where, you know, I'm just as happy to use Web API or ServiceStack, but I'm just as happy to use C# or Java or to code for Android or iOS, because all of those things, you know, there's something good about each one of those things. And I think it's so many people get caught up in these religious type of wars on technology, and it's so unneeded, because, you know, there's, it's funny. My two-year-old daughter actually taught me something. Whenever we ask her a question, we say, which do you like better, princesses or butterflies? She says, I like all of them. And I thought, gosh, that, you know, that she just kept answering that. And I thought, that is so, why can't we be like that? Why can't we just say, I like all of them?
Yeah, I buy that completely, except for Objective-C, which is evil.
I'm with you there. But yeah, I agree very much, John, that, you know, people love to identify with something and kind of like, I don't know if it's, you know, feeling like you belong or that you've picked the winner or that you're safe or whatever. But like, I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's I don't know. It's refreshing to be able to kind of see a lot of good in a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, I don't know. Like, I just personally, like, I don't have the bandwidth or the mental, you know, energy to like dislike something actively, you know, I'm too busy, yeah. like just trying to keep up with things. And, you know, I'd rather like things than dislike things, you know?
Exactly. Like there's enough room on the shelf for everyone. It's like, there's not, you don't have to like this one thing and then hate this other. You don't have to join a camp necessarily. And, mm-hmm. and people, I think you're right. To some degree, it's like whatever your skill set is, like you want to defend that and make that skill set become more valuable by knocking the other things, because and it's just a natural tendency. Like people want to do that, but it's, but I don't know. I've been just, and I'm like that myself naturally, but through this ordeal of doing all these Pluralsight courses of this, and going to all these different technologies, I've just kind of realized, oh, I was wrong. I was actually wrong about a whole bunch of things. And like these, you know, it's fun to make fun of these Ruby guys over here or the Node guys or whatever and stuff. But you know what? They're doing some pretty cool stuff. And the Ruby guys are doing some pretty cool stuff. And the Microsoft guys, and even in the Java world, you know, a lot of the, on the Microsoft side, we like to say, oh, those Java guys. But hey, they're, you know, they invented a lot of the stuff that we patterns and practices that we use, and they have a very mature environment. So there's like all this value all over the place. And, it's just, you know, it's sad. I think that we get divided so much over, mm-hmm. over technology.
Okay. This is going way too far into happy wood. So let me take you back into the technology. When I want to go back to Service Stack for a minute. When you go to the Service Stack site, they have this very nice graphic of a box, and you click on the box and it bursts open with all these technologies. Now, the only ones that I've really explored are the web service and the dependency injection and the ORM, and I've been very impressed by all three. Are there a lot of other sub-technologies in Service Stack that I should be looking at?
I think you've mostly hit on it. You know, I mean, that's the thing about Service Stack is it's like a stack that you open up and you've got everything that you need. You said that you've looked at the server side, the ORM, the
dependency injection.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And
did you mention serialization? Because I think that is a huge point too, is the serialization is very fast and there's support for a lot of different things like protocol buffers and, you know, kind of a lot of more advanced places where you could plug that into web API, or you could even use those serializers in web API. But I mean, with that, that's, I think, an area where the like advanced serialization support is a selling point for Service Stack. You agree, John? Or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think you know, it depends on how you test this thing, but at least at one point, you know, some of the tests had shown that they had the fastest, JSON serializer. But again, you know, I don't think I would, you know, be too worried about like how fast things are serializing, because they're all really fast now. But it is, the flexibility of the serialization was something that I thought was pretty awesome. You know, especially even on the side of like, you know, one real cool thing is, okay, you start up your Service Stack project, you expose your web service, and then all of a sudden you can make a request in all these different formats. You can ask for SOAP, you can ask for, you know, JSON, you can ask for JSV or CSV, and it all comes back instantly. You don't have to do anything special for that. So the way that it's all integrated in there with the different serialization capabilities is definitely pretty neat.
Yeah. You know, it is interesting, the whole thing you mentioned about the benchmarks and speed and performance. And I know that's a huge, I don't know. It's part of the passion behind Service Stack, is like, we want this thing to be insanely fast. And I respect that. And it is nice to like, depending if performance is something that, like, if just raw performance is really important to something you're working on, then it's where the benchmarks themselves may not be, like, most benchmarks are, you're doing an operation a million times. Well, I'm not going to do that you know what I mean? The same, right. Like they're always kind of like a little stilted, but on the other hand, it's nice to know that the development team is like, you know, really crazy laser focused on performance just in general. That kind of can be a nice, you know, if that's a major focus of what you're building, that can be nice to know that that's a major focus of the team as well.
Now, they've got a great slogan. Their slogan on their page is thoughtfully architected, obscenely fast, thoroughly enjoyable, which is kind of a nice combination. Let's talk, John, about some of the other technologies that you've explored in Pluralsight. And I want to start, if that's all right, with Android and iOS. Have you spent a lot of time with Xamarin as an alternative to writing in the native code?
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. I actually did, I think I'd done 3 courses on Xamarin stuff in for Pluralsight. My first courses were when it was called MonoTouch, and then the Mono for Android or MonoDroid. I really, really like the Xamarin stuff. And I'll tell you my story. I mean, I was against the MonoTouch and the Xamarin stuff when it first came out, when I was first doing mobile development, because I thought, okay, there's a catch here. You can't just, like, you're not going to get things for free. And you should develop in the language of the platform. And what I ended up doing was I started off as an Android developer, you know, developed my app, and then I ported that app over to iOS using Objective-C. And I have to agree with you, Objective-C was really painful. I think that some people that are really good at it perhaps would disagree, but it was definitely much more painful for me than the languages I was used to working with, C#, Java, and a lot of other dynamic languages. So once I had done that port, I had felt the pain. I had done Android development. I've done iOS development. I said, okay, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to put aside my bias. I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to get the Xamarin tools, and I'm going to build an iOS application over the weekend. And let's just see how this goes. If I can do this, then I'll change my tune. I'll go over to the Xamarin side of it. And, you know, I built this little peekaboo application, right? And it took me, a day, which I know for a fact, because I had just finished porting my iOS application over, or my Android application over to iOS. That same thing would have taken me like a week and a half, 2 weeks in iOS using Objective-C. So I was like, okay, this is pretty awesome. Like, this is definitely, and you know, with the Xamarin, I just really like C# as a language. And so that was a big appeal to me. And once I realized that, okay, this is not a scam, this is not false advertising, this is the real deal. This is a real native iOS application that I just wrote in C# in like a quarter of the time or less. And there's no drawback here. This is awesome.
Let me ask you, I want to zero in on Xamarin for Android. I have set as a goal to learn Xamarin for Android relatively slowly, taking my time and documenting the process. I note that you have a course, Mono for Android, from December of 2011. Is that, I don't want to put you on the spot, but is that still current enough that would be a good resource for me?
Yeah. What I would actually recommend is I released a newer course. I forget the exact title, but it is like creating cross-platform applications with Xamarin. I'm trying to see if I can find
cross-platform Android and iOS apps with Appcelerator. No, that's not the one. God, you have a lot of courses. Oh, and I see that you're in Steve Smith's Design Patterns library as well. So you have, and you did one with Iris Klassen. Very interesting. Okay, I'm vamping for you, hoping that you're going to find the name of the.
It's an MVC for iOS and Android app with ServiceStack, Xamarin, and C#.
Ah, okay.
And so that one, I'd recommend starting there, because what I do in that course is I say, okay, look, we're just going to build this real simple app, and we're going to create a backend in ServiceStack. We're going to build an MVC for front end, and then we're going to build an iOS and an Android front end for it, and we're going to use the Xamarin tools to do it. So I just quickly go through, you know, the very, very basics of the new Xamarin tools. This is a Xamarin 2.0. And I'm not going into depth into the stuff, but that's like good enough to get started, which the only thing that's changed is the getting started part. So if you go through that and then go for the older course, then I think that would be the best path, because really the technology hasn't changed aside from the IDE for the Xamarin stuff and then the newer version of Android, but the basics are still the same that are covered in that course. So.
Okay. And do you have any strong feelings about using the Xamarin workspace versus using Visual Studio?
You know, the Xamarin Studio has come along a long way. Like with MonoDevelop, which was the previous version of their IDE, it was kind of crashing a lot, and you know, it felt like an older IDE. But with the Xamarin Studio, I pretty much find that I'm using that now. I mean, I have the capability to use Visual Studio, and you know, I like Visual Studio. I use it a lot of the time, but I find like that the reason why I'm using the Xamarin Studio mainly for the Android and iOS development is because if I'm on my Windows machine, it's the same IDE. If I'm on my Mac, it's the same IDE. And I can jump back and forth between the two and not have to reset myself. So,
okay, John Galloway, I got to ask you, we've spent some time talking about these free products and these development environments. And in each of those places, I keep thinking, well, Microsoft doesn't really care, does it? Because Microsoft is giving away the same. I mean, it's not like Microsoft is making a bundle on, as you said, on web API. Visual Studio, I guess they care a fair amount about. So how does Microsoft balance that interest in open source and turning a profit on its development materials?
Yeah, well, gosh, I mean, I can't speak for the entire company. I can give kind of my thoughts on how things kind of work out. Generally, I think, you know, the idea, like, for instance, at Build this past summer, the Xamarin meetup thing, they were giving away C# shirts. And, you know, like they've said, we love C# more than Microsoft does sometimes, you know. And I mean, I think in general, if you've got a really healthy ecosystem of people developing on C#, that's got to be good for Microsoft in terms of, like you were saying, you know, Visual Studio is a great, you know, is a great editor for advanced C# development, all that. So there's, of course, you know, the free express versions of Visual Studio. But then if you want more, then you can upgrade and get, you know, get something else, or you may want MSDN. I think also across things like, Azure has been interesting in terms of, like, again, if people are building a lot of, you know, ASP, web API apps, things like that, there's a good chance a lot of those will go on Azure. And so I think it's kind of like, it's not always a direct thing, but I know, like, it's important for a healthy .NET and C# ecosystem to exist out there. And a lot of the time, what keeps open source developers happy about working on C# and .NET is that they're not just, you know, only runs on Microsoft. So I think it all kind of works out, especially with, lately with Azure running a lot of other things. Like, you know, there's Java, support. You know, you can run Linux VMs. You can run Node.js. I mean, there's all this Git support. So, I mean, in general, they're kind of moving towards, something that continues to make it easy to like open source and like Microsoft at the same time. And, you know, I think about this partly because I do like events and write content and I speak about, you know, web development on Microsoft platform. And it's kind of nice to be able to say, like, hey, most of this, just about everything I'm talking about today is open source. There's free, development environments for all of it. You know, go have fun.
Well, so. Memo to Scott Guthrie, who has done an extraordinary job, which is no surprise, is that Everything he's touching about Azure is great, except he needs to send out an official statement about how you pronounce it.
I've heard somebody say that it's pronounced like as you're walking by something or Azure, you know, like that kind of. But I know depending on it's. And no matter how you say it, people freak out. So I've decided to be wrong in one way, and I always say Azure.
Fair enough.
It's like the mono, right? It's like mono. I just started learning Spanish through like that Duolingo app, and Monkey came up, and it says mono, and I was like, wait a minute, I got it. Moment of clarity. That's what mono touch is. It's mono touch. Yeah. It's Monkey. That's why.
It is Monkey. He has said that it is the Spanish word for monkey, but everybody says mono.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I didn't even make the. I feel embarrassed because I was like, wow, I've been doing like working with this technology for this long. I didn't even really make the connection. Like I knew there was like had something to do. I thought Zimian, Xamarin, you know, but I had no idea. So.
Oh man, I have my little stuffed monkey that says Xamarin on it that I got at Bill.
Oh yeah, yeah. But you know, it's interesting on the Xamarin point too. I was pondering like why would Microsoft like Xamarin? And I mean, this is just my opinion or my guess, but it occurred to me that if you're not going to stop people from developing iOS and Android apps, but if they're developing them in C#, they're probably going to develop them for Windows Phone as well because it'll be easier. Whereas if they're developing them in Objective-C in Java, they're probably not going to port their app over to the smallest market share market. Because it's much harder. So to me, then I was like, oh, that would make sense to me if I were, you know, in charge of that. I would say, yeah, Xamarin, you know, obviously we would rather people not write iOS or Android applications, but it's going to happen. So if they're going to write them, if they write them in C#, there's a much higher percentage chance that they're going to bring them over to Windows Phone as well.
I think that's a great insight. And it's going to be very interesting because, and I was just talking with Steve Smith about this, Apple's decision was that their phone and their tablet would share an operating system, but their desktop would not. Microsoft decided that it would be the desktop and the tablet, but so far not the phone. And that puts Microsoft tablet in a really interesting position, or at least I should say it puts Windows 8 in an interesting position as to whether it's a desktop environment or a mobile environment.
It seems to me that everyone, like, I don't know. I mean, Google, for instance, their Chrome team joined up with their Android team. And, you know, and when you see that the newer versions of Mac, like with the, I forgot what is it, Launcher? I can't remember. Launchpad?
Yes.
It looks kind of like I can't imagine that Google and Apple don't make the same move that Microsoft beat them to the punch. I mean, the Surface is just, I just ordered my Surface Pro too. I was so excited about that thing. I can't wait to get it because it's awesome. It's exactly what, you know, I have an Android phone and I have an iPad, and you know, to some degree, they're both toys because I can't do any real work on either one of those things. They're fun. I like them, but and they were really fun 2 years ago. But now I'm like, well, wait a minute. The newness has worn off. I'm tired of the novelty. I just want something that does everything and I can work with. And that's why I think, to me, it seems like the Surface Pro 2, just is going to be perfect for that. And if Apple and Google don't make the same move, they're going to be in big trouble.
Do you think the Surface Pro 2 could replace your laptop, fully replace your laptop?
I'm actually going to have it replace my desktop. I actually just bought a 4K TV a monitor, crazy price, like $700 on Amazon. It only is like a 30 hertz refresh rate. But the reason why I bought it was because I'm going to hook my Surface Pro 2 up to it because it does support a 4K output resolution. And I'm going to try and use that as my main PC, as my desktop, as my laptop, as my tablet, as everything except for my phone. And I think I can do it.
Tell me about 4K. I'm sorry, John Kelly, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but very briefly, tell me about what does 4K mean in terms of a television or in terms of a monitor?
So the easiest way to describe it is a lot of monitors, right? TVs are 1080 right now, the HD.
Mm-hmm.
So just imagine 1080 resolution. Stacked a 2x2 grid of them. That's what a 4K monitor. That's the resolution of 4K.
I want that. John Gallo, you were about to say.
Well, I know several people at Microsoft that do that. I mean, I know people outside, but I mean, I know several people that I work with there was this difficult time where they had like this cutoff period of when everyone at Microsoft could get a new Windows 8 touchscreen device, you know? And so people were like, well, do I get the Surface? Do I get the ThinkPad? I ended up getting the ThinkPad Carbon X1, and I really like it. But it was really between that and Surface Pro, and especially the Surface Pro 2. It's that much better. But I mean, so yeah, it's definitely like performance is at a spot where, you know, you can, I know people that would, you know, do full on, you know, presentations and stuff using that.
Can you use it as a development machine, as a serious development? How much memory can you put in a Surface 2?
Let's look that up.
I think it's 8 gig. I think the one I ordered is 8 gig. I know that some people were, I mean, I heard of a lot of people using a Surface Pro 1 as their development machine. And for me, when I looked at the stats of the Surface Pro, I said, oh, it's almost there. This is exactly what I want, but it's not there. And then when I was listening to the Surface Pro 2 keynote, I was like frantically clicking the buy button because I was like, this is it. This is it. Here we go. This is what I want. So I think to me, the stats seem like, okay, this is enough to be able to power development machine. I can record Pluralsight courses from this thing. This is going to be it.